Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 498th episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the funniest people in show business, and has been for the past half century. He's a writer, actor, and variety specialist who has been nominated for 14 Emmys and 2 Tonys, winning one of each. In 1994, the New York Times described him as a comic chameleon. In 2018, Esquire called him a living legend, one of the last real utility players of comedy. And that same year, New York Magazine labeled him a comedy god, noting that he's carved out a singular career as a show business jack of all trades and is the type of funny where talk show hosts introduce him as the funniest man alive, adding, "It's a testament to his talent that he's attained pantheon status in the comedy world while never quite solely carrying one thing, blockbuster movie or hit sitcom or live special, that was a true mainstream success." Well, 5 years later, that caveat can be removed from the equation, as he is one of a trio of stars, along with longtime friend and collaborator Steve Martin and Gen Z queen Selena Gomez, who have made Hulu's Only Murders in the Building, over the course of 2 seasons, one of the most celebrated series on television. The man who on that show plays Oliver Putnam, a bankrupt Broadway producer now working with 2 neighbors to solve murders in their New York City apartment building, Martin Short. Over the course of our conversation from his home in Pacific Palisades, the 73-year-old Canadian and I discussed his lifelong passion for comedy, even in the face of tragedy. Indeed, between the ages of 12 and 20, he lost his oldest brother in a car crash, his mother to cancer, and his father to complications of a stroke. And 13 years ago, he lost his wife of 30 years to cancer. We talked about his roots in sketch comedy specifically at Second City and SCTV in Toronto, and then at Saturday Night Live in New York, prior to his move into movies and series television, and his ultimate return to sketch on The Martin Short Show, most famously as Jiminy Glick. We delved into his special friendship with Steve Martin, with whom he made the films The Three Amigos in 1986, Father of the Bride in 1991, and Father of the Bride Part 2 in 1995, and also toured extensively prior to Only Murders in the Building, and with whom he also hosted Saturday Night Live this season, plus much more. And so without further ado, let's go to that conversation. All right, Marty, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to have you. And on this
great
one,
to be here.
Thank you. Always begin truly at the beginning. If you could share with our listeners, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. And my father was the general sales manager of the Steel Company of Canada. And my mother was a classical violinist.
And you had a bunch of siblings, right?
Youngest of 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in prepping for this, I thought I knew a lot about you, but then I just learned so much in the last week or so, including, you know, just this terribly tough period that I guess you had between the ages of 12 and 20, where a number of your closest family members you lost. And there's an assumption, I know we had Stephen Colbert on this podcast, for instance, right. There's an assumption that this is what, and for some people, it is true, I guess, that kind of a terrible loss is what drives them towards, you know, laughing themselves or making somebody else laugh or whatever. However, I have read that that is a common misconception for you, right? This was going on even before.
Yeah, no, I think that the way you are raised and who you are and DNA makes you respond to certain tragedies in a glass half full way, some glass totally empty way. And some people use those kind of things as, see, the reason I'm a, you know, fuck up is not because I'm not talented. It's because look at the tragedies I went through. And for some, that is a valid thing. So you can't, you know, judge anyone, but it is fascinating. In my case, I grew up in a loose, funny, happy family. So when David died, our eldest brother, in a car accident when I was 12, you know, I had these four other or three other siblings. And to this day. So, you know, you handle it together, and there's humor involved, you know, even in the most tragic moments. And that's the way our family handled things. Very Irish Catholic.
And even, I mean, I guess that, do you think it actually was helpful in enduring these difficult things after, you know, that it was both?
I don't know. It's like, that's your normalcy.
Right.
That's my normalcy, you know. When I was 13, my mother was given a couple of months to live, and suddenly she lived for 2.5 years. So my normalcy, when I think of her, is not being sick.
Right.
I remember when she died, a neighbor, I'm standing by the coffin and at the funeral home, and a neighbor says to maybe my sister, she suffered for so long. And I went, what? No, she didn't. You're taking away my childhood. She didn't suffer. So that's your normalcy. You have a sick parent who's now in remission. Hey, that's your normalcy.
So having already been introduced to comedy, shown an interest in comedy before any of this, what was your exposure to comedy, that your initial exposure to comedy?
Well, I think, you know, it's trickled down in my family. My brother Michael is won many awards as a writer, everything from SCTV to Schitt's Creek. Mm-hmm. My father was hilarious, really funny. I mean, when I would do Glick, I think, you're channeling Chuck a little bit. And my brother Brian was funny. My sister Nora is hilarious. I'll go and spend the weekend with her this weekend in Palm Desert. You know, I think that's where I learned, because you're the youngest. And then you're coddled because everyone thinks you're so damn cute because you're the youngest. And then, you know, in the days of just one television in your living room, you're watching at night what your parents watch. And so suddenly I'm watching the Friday night Jack Parr show, and who's Oscar Levant? Who's Malcolm Muggeridge? Peter Ustinov? You know, but I have to find, and I find these people charming and fascinating, and I get a love of that kind of sophisticated show business.
And I guess, you know, somebody might assume you're primarily watching Canadian content, but in fact, I guess you're so close.
No. Well, Hamilton is, you know, 40 miles east of Toronto, and we're, I don't know, an hour and 15 from Buffalo. So our stations that we watched were ABC, CBS, and NBC through Buffalo.
Right.
Tonawanda, Cheektowaga.
So when you go off to university, I was surprised to read the initial inclination, it looks like, was pre-med, then sociology.
Social work. Yeah.
Social work.
Yeah.
And yet throughout all of that, there was some involvement with acting, theater. Had that even begun before university, or was that something you got into?
No, I didn't think it was cool in high school at all. I didn't do anything. But in university, you know, so my first 2 years was natural sciences, and there were a lot of courses and science courses and tough. But I was also being drawn toward, you know, I was in How to Succeed. I had one line, the big musical that McMaster put on once a year. And the next year I did it. And so I just started to become addicted every time there was a theater. And that was the problem. That's basically why I had to switch out of natural sciences. I needed to find courses that didn't take all my energy, because right, I needed a lot for the stage.
Right.
So,
with an idea towards, this is something I might be able to do professionally after
school? No, not remotely. Not that at all. It was just something I loved. But because I was in Canada and not in Manhattan, it seemed like a very unrealistic dream that you were watching something that might take place on Neptune, you know? So there was no plan to come down to New York or anything. That just was through osmosis.
So I guess, just in a sign of what a small world it is, one of your, I don't know if it was a roommate or just a close friend in university, was Eugene Levy?
He was not a, he would become a roommate. He was about 3 years, 4 years older. So I hired him to direct this musical because I was now the president of Proscenium. This is by year three. I've switched to social worker. I have more time. I'm just doing plays and we're doing the odd couple in the summer. And Eugene and I became great friends. And then he was the one who said, now I'm in fourth year university and he's in Toronto. He's, you know, a struggling actor and working on things, but not much. And he said, you know, you have talent. You should come, you should give it a shot. So I did, based on, I gave myself a year. And, but it was at his urging.
Now this, was it literally the very first thing that you went out for was Godspell?
Yeah.
And just correct me if any of this is wrong, but my understanding just...
No, the first thing I went out was for a talking Visa card.
Okay.
And I got that. And then I got Godspell.
Okay, so if any of this is wrong, please correct me. But basically, if I have it chronologically correct, 71 Godspell becomes this phenomenon off-Broadway.
In New York.
In New York. Next year, I guess throughout North America, they're going to try to do...
Well, no, the first sister company they did was going to be Toronto.
Okay.
For 3 months. Then we go to Boston. Then we go to Chicago. And it was a year contract.
So, okay. So it would be the one touring company starting in Toronto.
Right. Because remember, Godspell was, first of all, you know, Stephen Schwartz, who wrote it, who would then write everything in the world, was like 24. They were just kids. So this was off-Broadway in New York, Cherry Lane Theater, and it was a surprise hit. So now they were going to do this sister company.
So you and I guess Eugene and maybe others you know with you, you go line up. There's thousands maybe of people.
Well, these are the callbacks. These are the callbacks. And it was held in the Masonic Temple and I don't know how many people were called back. Let's say 300.
Mm-hmm.
But all their friends were in the... Because everyone wanted the show. Every actor wanted the show. And Hair had just been a big, big thing at the Royal Alex Theater. And, you know, big hits. And now that was ending. And so now the Hair people were, you know, woo! You know, they were stars in Toronto already. And yeah, and so that was that. So I was at the callbacks, and
I read
and Eugene got the callback too.
Okay, so and I read that your thing that I guess helped secure it for you, my funny Valentine. Is that what you're saying there?
Well, I remember thinking when Gilda got up. We didn't know Gilda.
Okay,
and she was in bib overalls with sideways pigtails. And she sang this very zippity dude. She had zippity doo-dah with great energy, and I thought, well, that's the saddest thing I've ever seen. Oh, dear God. And then you could see Stephen Schwartz and John Michael Tabalaka wrote the book, just jumping up, you're hired! And they just, and I thought, oh, wow, gee, and I'm going to sing my Bunny Valentine. I might have made a mistake. But it turned out I got it, and they hired Paul Schaefer that day, and Eugene, and Gilda, and Victor Garber, and it was amazing.
I mean, it really is, cause that so many, Andrew Martin. Yeah. I guess I wonder, because you were with them all for about a year, right? And this is now a production that clearly was a major moment for all of you guys. I believe you and Gilda dated during that time.
We did.
You know, but so many people who had, you know, went on to great careers. What made this group click so much?
I have no idea. I really don't. I mean, I think if you want to be objective to it, you'd say, well, Jesus, there's a lot of talented people. But I do remember, so Gilda and I were together off and on for a couple of years, and I remember one time, the first person who got a job to go to New York was Paul Schaefer. He was going to play The Magic Show, another kind of keeping it in the family, Stephen Schwartz production. Mm-hmm. And I remember Gilda and I were in a kitchen sharing a phone. And she said, Paul, what are New York actors like? And Paul said, well, I don't know what to say other than I know you're my friends. I think you guys are just as talented. And we got off the phone thinking, aw, that's so sweet of him. Not believing it because it was that kind of, you know, insecurity of having this powerful sibling to the south of you.
Well, so when your year with the production ended, I guess that's 73, which is the same year that Second City starts in Toronto.
That's right.
And many of your friends from Godspell immediately went out for that, right?
But you got it.
And got it. Why, you know, this is your crew. Why did you not join them immediately?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think obviously I was afraid of it. You know, I was considered the funny guy. And yet now this idea of being improvising funny, which is, of course, all that anyone does anyway in a car. So I thought that I would, they wanted it so much and I didn't want it like they did. And I thought maybe you have to want it like they do.
And you were more interested in...
I wanted to do musicals and plays and be an actor. And
so what was going on in those, basically from 73 to 77, and then what changes in 77 when you do now become part of this group in Second City?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, what was remarkable, I can't speak for Toronto now, but back then was it was a smaller pond, but you got to do everything. You could do a radio commercial, then you could do a part in a Shakespearean play for CBC, and then end the night by doing Second City or whatever play you were in. Harry's Back in Town, you know, Cold Cuts, the music of Cole Porter. I mean, there was always a cabaret or something to do. So the level of experience as a Canadian actor I was getting was way more than an average American actor, certainly in Los Angeles, who just kind of sits and hopes the phone rings. You weren't becoming a star or anything, but you were. It was like being in university. And so that's what I did for years, you know, just, and then but then at a certain point, SCTV started and I just could see my friends going up here and I was still da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So that's when I decided, you know what, I do want to do Second City.
At that point, by that point, you had already ended your relationship with Gilda and met the woman who would become your
wife. Yes, I was now with Nancy.
Nancy, and who had been also an understudy.
An understudy and Godspell. All roads go to Godspell.
Amazing. Yes. Uh-huh. But I guess one of the things that I think it was even on this podcast that Catherine O'Hara remembers was that when you joined Second City, there was, you know, for as funny as you would be out in front of an audience, you were very serious about studying even your own work, I guess, recording it, transcribing it, dissecting it.
Absolutely.
What was that about?
Well, I think that was, I probably had more confidence. This is right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I probably had more confidence as a writer than as an improviser. So I wanted to be able to, I would take home the cassettes because they were recorded. I would transcribe if it was a scene that I thought was interesting and could get better. And then I would rewrite it. I'd type it out and now I have a copy. Then I'd rewrite. Oh, what if I said that? So then you'd try it again that night. And that's how I would write.
So even
I also felt like I was 27. Mm-hmm. You know, Catherine was 22 or something, and others were now starting this kind of odd show on Global SCTV. And I just felt like I had to make up for lost time, you know, even though I was 27.
And it's just interesting because I know when we'll come back around to this when we talk about just what a star you are with late night appearances, but what I guess the thread connecting what we're talking about with Second City and that is that what you can make look spur of the moment, totally relaxed, like you've come up with it, there is actually a lot of work that goes.
Well, I mean, in a weird way, one feeds the other. For example, if when I would go home and transcribe those early Second City scenes and I'd look at them and I'd try to rewrite them and now you kind of, when you go out, you're gunning for bear a little bit. You feel a little confident, more confident. So suddenly you not only might try that line you wrote, but now your headspace is now getting into the place of improv. Mm. You know, culminating in, for me, in creating a character who was 100% improvised, Jiminy Glick. So, so that was teaching me with, you know, training wheels, how to improvise.
Can we talk about a couple of the examples of characters who I think you created at Second City and then they lived on at SCTV and SNL and elsewhere, but I mean, I think it was at Second City, right, where we first get Jackie Rogers Jr.
No, Jackie was created on SCTV.
SCTV. Okay, yeah. How about it'd be Ed Grimley there?
Ed Grimley was definitely created on stage.
On stage. So just to remind anyone who needs a reminder, completely mental.
Yes, Ed was a very enthusiastic person, I must say. Very excited to be filled with life, found life exciting.
Yes.
For example, I always like this one line that Ed said where the phone rings and he goes to answer it and then he pauses and looks to the audience and says, gee, I love the phone. There's always such a sense of mystery. So everything about life exhilarated him.
Well, and between, I must say, and a very decent guy and all of these, am I imagining that these are, is it almost like a play on a Canadian person, just a very polite, these are things that I associate more with Canadians than
American. Yes, well, they were. That would listen. I was in Toronto.
Yeah, right.
I was kind of doing a little bit of my brother-in-law Ralph. I was doing a guy I'd known in school. You know, you combine them,
right?
And the hair was only to make Peter Aykroyd laugh. We were doing a scene called Sexist,
right?
And it was a scene that John Candy had done in the show Wizard of Ossington. It was called Ossington's right. A Street in Toronto. And so John left, and I replaced John on stage. That's how I got in. And I was doing the scene Sexist that John had done about kind of a low-life guy and this very accomplished woman, and the manager of the company just can't decide between the two. And she gets indignant, and she storms off. And it's one of those scenes. And I decided to do it as Ed Grimley. I was kind of like talking like that. Then I would grease my hair a little bit, wear the pants high. And then Peter Aykroyd's, Danny's brother, said, you know, that hair is getting taller every night. So as a joke, I put it in a point.
Right.
And then the audience laughed. I thought, well, isn't that what I'm trying to accomplish here? So that Ed's hair was born, you know.
That's great. So you leave Second City in 78, but I don't think you start at SCTV for another...
No. Then I did a series in 79 for James L. Brooks.
Right.
Called The Associates. And that was on and off in 1 year. And then the next year I did I'm a Big Girl Now for ABC. Danny Thomas, Sherry North, Diana Canova.
Right.
And then the next year I joined SCTV.
So those other programs that you just mentioned had been your introduction to, first of all, I guess... television, secondly, American.
Oh, absolutely. Work. And James Brooks was the hottest guy in television.
Sure.
He'd just done all the Mary Tyler Moore, Phyllis Rhoda shows. He had two massive deals at Paramount to develop series. The first one was Taxi.
Yeah.
And the second one was The Associates. And he had 13 on the air, no pilot. That was his deal, you know.
Wow.
And it was amazing. And the shows were great. We just were, you know, in a bad position, and I don't know. It didn't click. But they were very well written.
And you were just as drawn to screen acting as you had been to stage acting up to that point?
Well, again, in Toronto, I'd done it all. You know, you didn't... It wasn't like, I'm a stage actor, I'm a film actor.
Right.
You just say, do I bring a suit?
Right.
You know?
Okay, so SCTV, which, as you said, was going up and running for a few...
Yeah, it was already hit when I joined.
Hit when you joined in 82, right? Mm-hmm. The conceit is that these are shows for this low rent station in Mellonville.
Right.
I guess in this case, can we talk about, this is overlapping with the beginning of SNL, early years of SNL, right? These are concurrently finding their thing.
Absolutely. Well, one has a budget and one doesn't.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, can we talk, because you would obviously soon after... do SNL, but the main difference is what? That you actually have some time to, you pre-tape for SCTV, right?
Well, first of all, by the time I joined SCTV, it was already a big hit.
Right.
So its budgets were great. And you know what I mean? That was all. But the main difference was that I remember we were writing our last season for Cinemax, and we were doing 18 shows. And we would have a writing season of, you know, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, and then we'd start shooting, and we'd keep writing. And the first 2 weeks, Eugene Levy couldn't, and he was a dominant writer, like the days of the week, the soap opera, he wrote every word.
Wow.
Where no one else, I mean, I just wrote stuff for me,
right.
You know. But he didn't have an idea in his head. He just kind of... Now, that was 2 weeks. Eugene had writer's block, and then it went away, and he made up for it. On SNL, you've just missed two shows, you know? I mean, the strange thing about SNL is that you can have a great show and feel like king of the castle. And then now it's Sunday, and you go to a hip brunch, and people say you were great, and oh, thanks. But by Sunday night, you're getting that thing in your stomach because you have to now meet Ringo Starr because you're a writer in the show, and you don't have one idea in your head. And early on when I was first doing it, while we were shooting pieces like, you know, synchronized swimming and stuff like Harry Shearer and I were doing it. And I said to Harry, you know what I want? You know, when we start doing the live shows, this is what I want to do. I want to always hold back a piece I want my friends to see, and tinker with it. Make sure it's really gives it that extra week of focus. And Harry looked at me and went, uh-huh. And then he put a piece of paper in the typewriter and typed up what I just said. And he then put it behind him and he said, now, when you come in on Tuesday night with not one idea in your head, I want to hear how that piece you're holding back for your friends is doing, you know? So that was, SNL. It's more final exams every week.
Did it make a difference to you that, as I understand it, there would never be an audience at for SCTV, right? Not a live audience in the way that there is.
No, we shot SCTV like a movie, right? And you go over, I once guested on Arrested Development, and Mitch Hurwitz did a very similar thing where the cast would go over, look at a playback, and you go, oh, okay, I see, I'm too big. Jason, you should be bigger. And then, okay, let's try it again. So it was just, that's how we did SCTV.
So SCTV, just because it's another big guy in your repertoire, you mentioned that is where we get Jackie Rogers Jr., cross-eyed, white-haired, albino,
that's right,
lounge singer. Mm-hmm. I read it in one place, was Mickey Rooney Jr. sort of an inspiration?
Well, it was, I seen a pic, right, listen, it could have been underdeveloped, but to me, I wanted to do a piece because everyone was doing, you know, Bill Murray had the big lounge singer and I always did a loungy kind of thing, but I thought, oh, well, that's passé. You can't do that anymore. What if I create a character who's killed? Then it's not passé because I'm killing him. And then at the end, we needed his son to come in and say, I miss my dad. I hope you won't Thursdays at 9, because it was now a special that had been shelved for 11 years since Jackie was died shooting it. But now they're going to air it. And I saw a picture of I guess, Mickey Rooney Jr. It was, yeah. And he just seemed like, in this picture, like an albino. So I said, well, I'll make him albino. And then, about a month and a half later, Eugene Levy had his character, Bobby Bittman. He said, I want to do a piece with Jackie Rogers. I said, the albino. He said, no, not the albino. I want to work with the father. I said, well, the father's dead. We can't, you have to work with the son. Well, I don't want to work with the son, the albino character. No. And then we ended up doing lots, you know, because there was no choice.
Right. So SCTV, 82 to 84. In 84, you did two things that I think are pretty uncommon in the history of SNL, which is now, what, like over 50 years?
Approaching.
You joined on a one-year deal, and you left after that year.
That's right.
Why those two things? I know that at SNL, just to kind of set the scene for your answer, I think Eddie Murphy's just left, right?
Eddie had left midway through the season, and then now Joe Piscopo had left.
Okay.
And I think there was a real sense this show could be canceled.
Mm-hmm.
And like back then, they didn't even have a wig department. They just, it was 10 years old, but they still just rented each week, each show, you know? So, They gave Billy Crystal. Billy and I had the same management, Rollins and Joffe. So they negotiated a very lucrative one-year contract for Billy and myself. And I don't know what Harry and Chris got paid, but I know that they also got a one-year contract because everyone was established. I mean, they had just that summer had Spinal Tap. It was the hippest, biggest film that everyone was talking about. And that was the summer. Now we're going into SNL.
Yeah.
So the idea that, you know, there was apprehension by everyone's part. I mean, I still have the pro and con list of whether I should do it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
What were the main considerations?
Well, I appreciate it was SNL. And first of all, we just rented a house out here. We had a baby. And I had just done 2.5 years of a grueling schedule of SCTV. So I was kind of looking forward to being in California. I also thought, gee, I've developed a nice little culty rep right now from SCTV. Do I want to destroy it by being on SNL? Is SNL funny? All those questions.
And it was, I guess, the year before you came, that was the Gene Dumanian year, and then the year you're there is Dick Ebersol, is that right? So had Lorne was not even a part
of it. No, Lorne was not part of it. That's the 80 to 85 era, yeah, that he was not there.
So only because, obviously, you and he then connect after your SNL run, but right. I mean, that was just totally unrelated.
Well, I'd met Lorne backstage at Godspell.
That early?
Yeah, yeah. He was, you know, he was a TV star.
Oh, right.
The Hart and Lorne Terrific Hour on CBC. And he was married at that time to one of the biggest Canadian stars ever, Frank Schuster of Wayne and Schuster. That was his first wife, Rosie.
Wow.
So, but no, I never really worked with Lorne until we did Three Amigos.
So I guess before Three Amigos, though, so 84 is when you join and leave SNL. Why only the year? If it was it your decision, you just didn't want to do it anymore?
You know, it was always a year contract because no one knew what's happening in the show and they didn't want me to be tied up. And that was the lure to get us to do it 1 year. In retrospect, I wish I hadn't had it because what I did is I treated every show like it was a special, mm-hmm, you know? And I wish I'd known I was going to be there 5 years. I would have relaxed, you know?
Was there one character or show that you're proudest of from that year you were there?
You know, I don't tend to watch things. In fact, I remember Davey Wilson was the director, and he was the original director. And I remember on the Monday, I went to the office to get a VHS in those days of the show. And Davey said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I want to look at the show." He said, "No, don't look at it. It happened. It went. You'll only look for faults. Let it go." But when I look back on that first show, and it had strong pieces in it, all over the place. It was a really strong show. And I remember the dress was so bad that my wife came and I said, "This is a disaster." And she was devastated.
Yeah.
You know, we'd moved down. I said, "I'm telling you, they should show an old show. It's bad." And then she was so pissed off afterwards because it was a triumph. And she went, "Why would you?" I said, "I'm telling you," because I didn't realize what could happen between dress and
I was going to ask, how do you explain that? Because I've often, you know, even in the Tom Shales, Jim Miller book about SNL, that seems to be a recurring thing where one has nothing to do with the other.
Well, you know, in comedy, if you have a bad joke, it affects the next three jokes. So a piece that doesn't work affects the next two pieces. It affects the confidence of the cast. Or maybe that piece works great at 3 minutes, but unfortunately it's seven. Mm-hmm. So those things can change between dress and air and where you position things. And
interesting.
Yeah.
So coming out of SNL is really the beginning of your movie career. And can I just prompt you about a few of these?
Yes.
That, you know, people really remember. I think, you know, Three Amigos, I didn't remember how abused you guys were for that movie in the immediate, yeah, aftermath. It was pretty harsh. So obviously, you, Chevy Chase, and I think for the first time, Steve Martin, did it feel when you were making it that it was working? Or what? Like, why, how do you, were you taken aback by the response to it in 86?
You know, I can't remember. I must have been taken aback. But I also, you know, I'm sure I'd been to a screening where I thought, "Oh, does that work?" You know what I mean? I'm not like that. Oh, laughing. I'm probably my own worst critic in that respect. Yes, I think there was just so much expectation from the three of us. They felt I was muted and Chevy was this and Steve was that. And then, of course, 10 years later, it's the cult comedy of the 80s.
Is there any explanation for that?
I do think that a lot of these things is box office. You know, if that film makes $1 billion, people right away are saying, it's special,
right.
You know? And if it's a box office disappointment, they'll go, well, you see, because they were, you know, you can't straitjacket Marty, you know, those phrases happen.
All right. So the next year, 87, you're with Joe Dante for Innerspace, which another highly anticipated one. And it did end up winning for Best Visual Effects at Oscars. But I guess also at the time seen as a bit disappointing in the performance.
Yeah, they wanted to make more money.
Yeah.
What a shock.
Yes. 89, Christopher Guest and The Big Picture.
Yes.
Any memories of that one in particular?
Well, yeah, I just shot 2 days, I remember. And I had big welts on the side of my head because we were curling my hair and spraying it orange. And then I wanted to look like I had had a bad facelift.
Right.
But Chris said afterwards, he said, you know what we should have done, and never explained it, was in one scene you have big bags, and the next scene they're not there, and we never explain it.
Well, okay, so then both 91 and then, of course, 95, the two Father of the Bride films, Frank Egelhoffer,
yes. Mm-hmm.
Wedding Planner Extraordinaire. The interesting thing about this one is that from what I read, there were some concerns out of the gate that you're in a different movie than everybody else, right?
Well, I think we all worried about it a little bit. And I remember the president of Disney, we were on a flight, and he said, well, it looks like you're having fun out there, which meant, I said, well, what does that mean? Because I knew him. He said, well, you know, I mean, sometimes you say yes, and sometimes you say yeah. I said, yeah, well, I think it's all effect. I think he's from somewhere, but whatever his accent.
Right.
It's like, you know, a movie star from New York randomly saying, y'all. You know what I mean? It's all, you don't worry about it.
Right.
And, but we would do a lot of takes where it would be turned down, turned down, turned down, turned down. I remember at one point, Steve Martin said, well, I don't get it. Now I understand him perfectly. Because it was supposed to be that Steve couldn't understand them, but Diane and Kimberly could, right. And that symbolized the alienation of his process in this development of a wedding.
All right, in between those two Father of the Bride films was Clifford in 94. Uh-huh. I think it actually...
We actually made it in 90.
I was going to say, because yeah. This Orion bankruptcy...
They went bankrupt, yeah.
Yeah. So you, Dances with Wolves, and Silence of the Lambs, were those three always make sense together.
Absolutely.
That's another one that in a way I feel like Three Amigos at the time maybe got crapped on and then people came around on it.
Well, because it was so bizarre. Anytime you do, you know, there's a line that Sondheim does in Sunday in the Park with George, all they ever like is repetition. All they ever want is what they know. So if you do something like where a 40-year-old guy is playing a 10-year-old boy, it's you're gonna get the lovers and you're gonna get the haters.
Right.
And here's what I know about the haters. I wouldn't want to have dinner with them. I'd be bored.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they found each other now on Twitter.
So absolutely.
Okay. Mars Attacks, 96. This
yes.
is for Tim Burton, very different or interesting filmmaker. Any thoughts? I mean, just that's quite an ensemble that you're part of there.
Oh, yeah. People were taking pictures of the chairs, I remember, because it was Rod Steiger and Pierce Brosnan, Jack Nicholson.
Right.
And Michael Fox. And me, it was hilarious. Oh, and Sarah Jessica Parker was in it.
Sure.
Everyone was in that movie. Pretty Glenn Close, of course.
Yes.
Were in the scenes I was in because I was the press secretary.
Yes. Jerry Ross.
That's right.
And then just flash forwarding for a moment, because this is another just, I can't imagine too many other, I don't think I can imagine anyone but you playing this for another very interesting filmmaker, Paul Thomas Anderson, the basically what pedophile dentist
yes.
in Inherent Vice,
uh-huh.
A strange movie anyway, but absolutely. This guy, you know, quite a character.
And Paul was spectacular to work with. It was like, again, I was expecting because of his films, an eccentric, you know, brooding or something. He was just like, he's like a UCLA film student.
Right.
Okay, so what are we going to do? I mean, and we'd do 8 takes where normally it would take 2. Marty, get out of the car. Go ahead and say the line again. Do you want me to say it louder? Sure. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, just kind of hopefully stumbling on some magic.
Right. Back to the small screen, I want to talk about somebody who I think, you know, might be as closely associated with you as any of these characters, and that is Jiminy Glick, who I think we first see in the Martin Short show number two version,
this
99 to 2000, and then of course Primetime Glick 2001 to 2003, the movie in 2004. Just to read a couple of quotes to remind people of how special this guy was. New York Times wrote, quote, "When the show is at its best, Martin Short is the funniest man on TV," close quote. And they say that the character is, quote, "television's most inspired madman," close quote, and, quote, "the most unpredictable and hilariously uninhibited comic creation to hit TV since Bart Simpson was in diapers," close quote. Just because he's so out of left field, I wondered where he came from. In trying to find the answer to that myself, I came across a few obituaries for a guy, Skip E. Lowe, who died in 2014, mm-hmm. LA Public Access TV host, that claim he was the inspiration, but was he in fact the inspiration?
Well, he was one of the inspirations.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, but in the subtle things, not his look, although what used to make me laugh hysterically about Skippy is that they'd do like tan number three on him, very dark makeup.
Right.
But they'd never do his hands, so he put his white hand up to his chin to listen. But he had that kind of Glick intensity. But then there was, you know, a neighbor in our street when I was a kid whose voice kind of went up and down. So it was a little bit of that. There was a guy I worked with who was in production that I'd be in my office and I'd hear, this for a different show, and I'd hear him going, "Ha, ha, ha, ha." And I think, okay, that has to be someone's laugh someday.
Right.
And then the look was created because I'd made a movie called Pure Luck, and I was stung by a bee, and then I swelled up. And I remember my wife saying on the set, "I don't see you in there." And I wanted to create someone that no one would recognize me, because we had tried that going to, you know, farmer's market. And hey, Mr. Short. And go, wait a second, I'm in 2 hours of makeup.
Right.
Nobody knows. But I'd done too much of that already. But Glick made me, I could go anywhere and no one knew it was me.
I was going to say, I mean, unless I'm forgetting something, you with him, and I think basically at the same time concurrently in the UK, Sacha Baron Cohen with Ali G and
right.
Borat, like this was a new kind of comedy basically, right? Where you're...
Well, Glick's was more practical. I had a talk show.
Yeah.
And I thought we could use Jiminy Glick as someone who could go to junkets and go to the Emmys. And we now have, you know, Tom Hanks and Jack Lemmon on our show. We can promote it at the top of the show because they're sitting down with Jiminy.
Did anyone who you interviewed not know in advance?
Jack Lemmon. And it was the first time I'd ever done him.
Really?
And he came over and I said, "Was Harry Cohen at Fox mean?" And he went, "Well, no, not really. I mean, he was very kind to me." And I realized he was answering sincerely. And I thought, oh God, I don't want
to,
we won't use this because I don't want to make Jack look like he's not in touch. I adore Jack Lemmon.
Sure. Was the challenge of playing this guy primarily just, it's such a physical ordeal to become him, or was it like...
No. In fact, the opposite. You could flip out of a chair and be padded. So that's why he could do great physical stunts in those chairs. And no, well, you see, again, we edited. So you were trying to find edge, but not be mean.
Right.
But I remember we would normally do an interview for about 8 minutes, and then we'd take a break, and we'd say, "Now, anyone else?" And the writers would come in. And I remember interviewing Alec Baldwin, and I said, "Alec, anything? Ask me about women." All right. So then, in the next segment, I keep bringing up Hillary Clinton when she's banging at your door at 3 a.m, man. You know, it's all that stuff. And then you edit it together, and it seems seamless.
Was it immediate that you realized this guy was special, would click with people, or did you have to hear that from audiences?
I think, truthfully, I've never been terribly driven by what the audience says. I just kind of, I mean, obviously, if it's supposed to get a laugh and it gets no laugh, it's gone. Right. Don't get me wrong. But I start with what would make me laugh.
Right.
And then you hope you have a similar taste.
Just briefly, two other TV things before we get to the present. But Uncle Jack Dorso, who I didn't even put together at the time on Arrested Development, this is as in jacked torso, I think, right?
He was a bodybuilder.
Right.
Yeah.
It took me too long to realize that. But this is one episode, Arrested Development, and Esquire, just as one example of people responding, that you come in for maybe the whole thing is just a couple of minutes, and they say the funniest 2 minutes of your life. And it really, I watched it again this morning just to be fresh. It's so physical, so creative. To be able to just jump into a show that's up and running and have a fully fleshed out character and make the most of just a short amount of time. Can we take that character as an example? Is that daunting, fun, scary? What is that?
No, it wasn't scary. Because again, I knew how they were working, that we would do a take, look at it. Oh, okay. But we kept adding stuff. Mitch kept adding stuff. And we had a bodybuilder, Dragon, who was and he had muscles like this,
yeah.
But at a certain point, it doesn't matter who's lifting you, you wear them out.
Yeah.
And he was so upset because he just couldn't lift me and he was burned out. And I kept saying, it's all our fault, you know, because I remember Mitch adding the thing about to the nuts.
Yes.
And they put me down to Jason Bateman's crotch.
Right.
And I, bridge mix, I'm saying, against his crotch. But, you know, where Jason is brilliant is that when you were, I remember we were doing a take, and as we had more to do, but in the middle of it, I just pretended to fall asleep and fell into his lap, back to his lap yeah. again. And he just went on with the scene and played it as if this old uncle had fallen. I mean, he's that good.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, every Will Arnett and the whole cast
great
is
group.
Spectacular.
Last of these other examples, just of things to talk about, Leonard Winston in Damages. This
oh, yes.
was a kind of a Bernie Madoff sidekick kind
absolutely.
Of guy.
Absolutely.
That was actually, you know, in some ways I think will be looked at as a turning point of a show for, among other reasons, that it was the beginning of the end, I think, of this. There's lines between who are film actors, who are TV actors with Glenn Close and other people. It just
right.
became, but just...
Well, you know, this Kessler Brothers, they had a real belief that comic actors were more interesting to them than just if you were an actor. So, I mean, certainly if you're Lily Tomlin, for example, you're funny, but you're acting that perfectly mm-hmm. and capturing something that's funny in life, but you're acting.
Yeah.
So that's, I remember when we first, the first scene we shot in Damages, it was Glenn Close. And then it was Lily, and I was her lawyer. And Glenn saying, guys, this isn't fair. I can't look at these two and get through all this dialogue. And, but at one point, you know, we did a take, and one of the producers came up and said, Marty, can you not smile in this scene? Because when you smile, you're Martin Short. And I said, well, I am Martin Short. and you know, the worst human beings in the world smile.
Oh, yeah.
So... I'm going to smile.
Yeah.
And they then later said, we were wrong and we were just getting panicky, you know?
Okay. So when actors do projects, and we've talked about many of them that, you know, film, TV that you've done, they go on talk shows to promote them. And you have been described by the Los Angeles Times as, quote, the funniest talk show guest on the planet, close quote, by the New York Times as, quote, an almost perfect talk show guest, close quote. The New Yorker wrote that you have, quote, made several generations of hosts lean back in their chairs and laugh. He cracked up Carson, he cracked up Leno and Conan and Fallon, close quote. And Stephen Hunter of the Washington Post once wrote, forgive me, this is him saying, quote, if making bad movies gets short on Letterman, then bad movies are okay by me. I'll even go see him just to sustain Short on the talk show circuit, close quote. So what is the key to being such a effective talk show guest?
I think you prepare. You prepare a lot. And again, some, you know, hosts would hit everything you prepared and some would hit some of it.
So you're not only preparing yourself, but you're looping in the hosts about what you're
doing. Yeah, I mean, you'll say, I mean, I would send in many pages, and in caps would be the host's question to me. Now, of course, the understanding that they would phrase it the way they want, mm-hmm. but also I would also, you know, I'd be on the phone with someone doing the producer's segment mm-hmm. of my appearance for an hour and a half. With Matt Roberts at Letterman, we would have dinner at Orso the night before because we were always doing songs that Matt wrote. And so I think you just prepare, and then it gives you the confidence to come out. But I remember very early on thinking, I know what this is. This is, you're trying to capture yourself really loose at a dinner party. but you don't have the 40 minutes going in. You have to just get there. So you have to do an impersonation of yourself really loose.
Is that, that sounds easier said than done. I mean, I would imagine it's a, you are, have again, a short.
Well, it's focused. You're kind of, I mean, but also I'm working with great, great people. Johnny Carson was phenomenal to work with. And Letterman, you know, Letterman, we were now peers, you know, in the sense of our age. And one time I was on Letterman and the audience was laughing. I said, what are they laughing at? And Dave said, nothing we're doing, you know.
All right. So this brings us up to 2021, where we've got Steve Martin, who we've already established you'd worked with going back to Three Amigos in 86. I think you might have even met him, you once said, before that briefly. But
right.
You worked with him on that. You worked with him on the Father of the Bride films, maybe even other
things. Prince of Egypt.
Yes, Prince of Egypt.
And he's in Jiminy Glick and Lalawood.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So 2004 for that.
Yeah.
And then at some point, you guys, this evolved into both a good friendship and a recognition that you could tour together, be funny together, doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Why Steve Martin versus Chevy Chase versus some of the other funny people you've worked with? What was it that you two
Well, about? You know, it is interesting. You make these movies and sometimes you're in everyone's life for 3 months in Istanbul and then you never see them again, right? But Steve, I'm certainly made, I thought, you know, I won't lose this guy. He's too interesting. Mm-hmm. But the live shows just started. We were asked by the Just for Last Comedy Festival in 2011 if we would close it, just interview each other. And that was it. And it was successful. And I already had a show, and he had a music show. So we just ended up combining them.
Mm-hmm. And at some point, I mean, he had not, I believe, acted on television in decades, right? In any, if ever.
Only SNL.
Right.
He had never been on a TV series.
Right. And you obviously had, but I guess I just wonder this idea. It sounds like he maybe independently or somehow had this thought originally that there's going to be a show about three older guys before it even, forget the what became Selena Gomez, right? How did it evolve to the point where it's not the three older guys, but you and he are talking about it being you two?
Well, it was in stages. Steve says that he was at a party years ago at Sandy Gallen's. Mm-hmm. And Sandy said, there were three older actors sitting on the couch, and Sandy, you should do a show about them. And Steve thought about it and said, well, that's a good idea because Steve loves true crime. All those, he watches them all the time. So he thought about three guys who are solving something in a building.
He just mentions this to you after having...
No. He was just mentioning to himself in his own brain.
Okay.
And he thought it was funny that they were at an age where they'll solve a murder, but it has to happen in the building. They're not going downtown. They're not traveling.
Right.
And that was it, and it just sat in his brain for a few years. And then he had a lunch with Dan Fogelman and a couple years ago. I think it was during COVID 2020, and Dan said, do you have any ideas? And Steve, I had this one idea. And then it just kept evolving into, then John Hoffman got involved. And then it wasn't three older people. It was someone young, and we started shooting in 2020.
But the idea that it would be you and Steve, I mean, again.
Oh, so Steve phoned me and then told me about it and said, would you be interested in doing this?
So do you think Steve was looking to get into TV series acting, or that it just occurred to you guys when you're talking about this project that it would, like, did he conceive of it for himself and you, or was it?
No, I bet. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I kind of know it for sure. I'm sure that it was Dan Fogelman saying to Steve, well, Steve, this could be a great show, and would you consider being in it? Because that's, Steve had never done a TV series. It's a big announcement. And I think he looked at the idea of it would be fun to work with me and asked me, and I said, sure. And then now it was Selena's name.
Well, so that part of the equation is so interesting because I get why you and Steve would look forward to working with each other, feel confident that you can make it work with your parts. But when this idea of having a young woman introduced to this is raised, was that something that gave you?
Oh, I thought it was a great idea.
You did.
Right off the bat, I thought, oh, that's a great idea.
Because there's just inherently so much potential for miss.
Well, because I get bored, you know, with the endless, and how old is he? And how old is he? Now that I'm old, you know, I never cared about it when I was 25.
Right.
But so to me, by introducing someone who's 28, it's taking away the age factor. It's this idea that, well, you can't be friends with someone who's 28 because mm-hmm. you're 70. Mm-hmm. That's preposterous, you know.
So you're obviously playing Oliver, this broke Broadway producer who's, I guess, once he gets involved with this podcast, hoping that it might bring him back closer to his son.
No, I don't think it's about his son. It wasn't about his son. It was just, you know, he's a guy who's like any actor or anyone in showbiz. You go from project to project with your fingers crossed. But he doesn't have any money. He went to his sons to ask for more money.
Money. Okay.
And the son said, I can't do it.
Okay, so
he's a vet.
Were these specific characters, it feels like they fit you guys like gloves. Like the idea,
right.
you have made a specialty over the years, whether it's specific characters you played, or even I think the character of Martin Short that you play when you're playing yourself, of, you know, narcissistic,
right.
self-obsessed guys.
Mm-hmm.
Was this guy going to be that even before you were playing him, or did you guys massage the characters to fit your strengths?
You know, everyone's exploring at the beginning. James Brooks had a story that I've quoted a million times and probably have it completely wrong, but the gist of it was, it's, you know, season 3, episode 2 of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and he turns to Stan Daniels, his partner, says, I think we figured it out. But it takes some time. So, but I do think we played into our relationship. And then, you know, if you improvise a line, they love that. There was no one like, in the first episode, Steve is saying, well, I just think, and I say, no need to yell. Now, that's something I would say to him as a joke.
Right.
That's in the show,
right.
That kind of thing. And Selena is just spectacular. But when the first day we shot, I had never met her. So I was on the drive there thinking, geez, I mean, I hope she's great.
What did you know about her going into this?
Well, I knew about her life and her music, and I'd seen her. I'd actually been doing the Lauren hang at an SNL when she performed during a big storm, and the musical guest.
Yeah.
And then I'd just seen her in the Woody Allen film. So, you make an effort.
Sure. There's sort of a curiosity I think you've heard from other interviewers that, and probably fans as well, like, is there any mirror of the characters' dynamic with each other with you and Steve and Selena? Is there sort of, generational misunderstandings or things like that? Or are you guys just actually pals?
I would say we are actually pals.
Yeah.
I mean, one of her favorite days was reading, rap lyrics to us, and we're going, what? You know?
I think it was Cardi B, right?
Yeah.
It was WAP.
Right. And it was WAP. And she was just laughing hysterically.
Right.
And I would say to her, well, here's Selena. Here's the thing. I'm trying to figure out what's better. Okay, I'll give you one version. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high. Or somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I dream of once in a lullaby. She says, okay. Oh, fuck yourself.
Yeah. Okay, so season one drops, and let me just note, it was embraced to the extent that within the first 2 weeks of the first episode, there's a renewal for season two.
Mm-hmm.
New York Times review begins, quote, begins, Martin Short gives a masterclass in Only Murders in the Building. It's not a class in acting or comedy so much as it's a seminar in agelessness and professionalism and in Short's unmatched ability to turn self-absorption into a virtue. You wish he were on screen every moment, close quote. Mm-hmm. Not bad, right?
Not terrible, no.
Did you, again, were you confident before you got any audience feedback that you guys and had done something special, or did you have to get that?
Well, I mean, you kind of work with people and you can tell, you know, there's dinners earlier and you, if you're good at kind of creating immediate intimacy with people, you know, if they're going to be honest with you, mm-hmm. there's nothing gained in their lying. So in the early days we would hear, oh my God, the studio loves this. Oh my God. They have no notes, you know, all that stuff, which is rare. Mm-hmm. And then you look at it yourself and go, yeah, not bad.
Not bad.
And so, you know, you go into, that doesn't mean it's going to be successful, but it certainly means one of the hurdles is over.
Totally. And then just the fact that you and Steve both nominated for the Emmy, you had, there were some very funny, I think the New York Times got you guys to talk about the fact that you're up against each other, yeah, and have fun with that, but come back with season two. Shirley MacLaine wants to be part of season two. I think season three, which we have to look forward to now, was Meryl Streep.
Paul Rudd.
I mean, just when you signed up for this show, I guess in the best case scenario, did you imagine that, you know, it's going to be year ongoing for years with these kind of people wanting to join your troupe? I mean, this is, to me, it seems like it's got to be best case scenario.
Well, listen, we've also had Amy Schumer and Sting.
Yes, yes.
No, it's fantastic. It's no, but you don't really do any of this like that. You don't go, gee, I wonder if this film will make $300 million and I could win an Oscar. You don't go there. You're just trying to get through the first hurdle. Is it too long? Is it no good? God bless us, we tried, you know?
Right.
And then when it seems to work and people like it and it works on levels that even surprise you, it's very gratifying.
I mean, we're sitting here in LA right now. The show, I think, does shoot in New York mostly. Mm-hmm. Is it, I mean, I imagine part of this is that's, you have to pick up your life and go and do something. If you're not having fun doing it when you're, you know, schlepping to New York and doing all that. Like,
oh, absolutely. I wouldn't at this stage in my life work in a show that had horrible vibes and jerks screaming at people. No, right. It wouldn't happen.
Right.
I don't think it would perceive either.
Right.
Or Selena.
So final question, I guess, just is, you know, in the course of an hour, we've gone over all the amazing things you have done. Is there anything beyond just enjoying your work that you specifically still have on the bucket list? Are there things that particular goals of yours, or you just see where?
No, I have no bucket list.
Yeah.
I mean, I just kind of feel that at 73, I would have done them. And maybe there's a reason you shouldn't have done them. I mean, in my life, I've been asked to direct a movie. And I thought, now Steven Spielberg had a little camera when he was 9. That's who should be directing movies.
Right.
But I was up in my attic, you know, with a gooseneck lamp, because even then I knew I needed lighting, and a spoon pretending to do a variety hour on NBC in my head. He should be doing that, you know. So, no, I don't have bucket lists. I would have done them.
Right. Well, glad you're doing what you do. Thank you so much for
my pleasure.
Doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate it and would really appreciate you taking just a minute more to subscribe to the podcast and to leave us a rating and review on your podcast app. And to follow us on Twitter and Instagram, where our handle is @AwardsChatter. On those platforms, we announce upcoming guests and provide details about special live recordings of the podcast that you can attend. Until next time, thanks again for tuning in.